Warning, this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Molasses Manifesto.
How long after you saw that movie did you go out with a knife, attacked a woman, and she screamed? And you let her go, and you fled.
She wasn't really hurt or anything, you know. I don't know what happened, you know. It's just, I didn't know what to do with all these frustrations and anger being built up, you know. Just started, at that point, that was when it was starting to turn out, what you see.
Why did you let her go after you had her?
Because I didn't really want to do anything, you see.
Did you?
I was confused, like I was driven between two points.
A Molasses Manifesto production, brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. the Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog, carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
And now the need for a story, if not for anybody else, for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should spend my whole life here for what I've done.
Episode 9, The Deadly Tower. Act 1, Charles Whitman. In the fall of 1975, just a little more than a year since he returned from the military, there was a massive, fundamental sea change going on inside David Berkowitz. The anger he had always felt his entire life was changing direction. The limitless inferno of frustration and rage inside David Berkowitz that had always been securely pointed inward towards himself was now pointed outward towards others. And it happened just about the time, well, exactly at the time, that David Berkowitz met his birth mother, Betty Falco. Within 6 months of meeting her, David Berkowitz would commit his first violent act against a woman. Jack asks David if, prior to the attacks, he ever considered ending his own life.
Did you ever think of turning the gun on yourself?
Yeah.
What stopped you from that?
Because my anger just happened to be outward. See, I'm the type of person that all my life I was blaming myself, feeling guilty because I thought I caused the death of my mother. But really, I wanted to turn that anger. I blamed others, you see. My anger began to turn around completely, reverse itself, and go outward. Because I began to say, well, it's not my fault. And this is after I found out that my mother was really alive and that I didn't cause her death. And everyone, once it went outwards, then I became destructive towards others instead of being destructive towards myself. So the idea of killing myself didn't really come. It was not something I was going to do, although I felt depressed sometimes, but not exceptionally depressed, you know. Mostly just angry, even though I couldn't admit it to myself. I kept the anger inside.
David wasn't interested in dying. David wanted to live. And he was, now, consciously considering taking out his hostility on others. That being said, he didn't just run out the door and start attacking people. Being a cautious fellow, he began to research murder and murderers alike to find a person, a style, that fit. In fact, it became a sort of hobby, a pet interest, if you will.
Can you think of what it was in you that made you homicidal rather than suicidal?
Yeah, I was reading, as I said, a lot of books and movies about other individuals who took their problems out on other people, you see. I was always turning the anger inward to myself. But here I was seeing these other guys acting out their angers and frustrations on other people.
It seemed like any reading that he did or movies that he sought out to watch were serial killer sort of sagas. And it seemed he identified with these individuals who, like him, were described as solitary and angry and having maybe good intentions and a military history and everything having blown up and gone the opposite way of what they had intended. So he began to nurture that identity as a counterculture stalker and killer.
David Berkowitz was a true crime fan, and when he started in, he began with what you might call the quote-unquote heavy hitters.
You mentioned some of the stories about criminals that you read before you started.
I used to read them in the library all the time. Oh, the Boston Strangler.
Did that movie?
A long time ago.
Released in 1968 and starring Tony Curtis, The Boston Strangler was a highly stylized film detailing the crimes of Albert DeSalvo, who raped and murdered 13 women in the Boston area between 1962 and 1964. The film was hugely successful and proved to be a comeback vehicle for Curtis, reviving his career. And while the film certainly worked for Curtis, it didn't quite work for Berkowitz, and there was one particular reason as to why that seems to jump out. In addition to being a murderer, DeSalvo was also a convicted rapist, which didn't fit for David. Sexual assault didn't jive with him. It's weird to say about someone who is okay with taking someone else's life, but assault of this nature was over the line for David. It was too physical, too confrontational, and really too sexual, so he kept looking. He also looked into Zodiac, the as-of-yet unidentified killer who stalked and killed young men and women in the San Francisco Bay Area between 1968 and 1969. Zodiac liked to shoot young couples in cars parked along lovers' lanes. He also mailed taunting letters to the police. Sound familiar? It should, since both of these Berkowitz would do later while perpetrating his murders, although he could never quite seem to give any of the quote-unquote credit to Zodiac. He did admit to seeing the film, though.
Zodiac, I also saw the movie, too.
So DeSalvo was close, and Zodiac was closer, but despite all these obvious connections between Berkowitz and Zodiac, none of these guys seem to want to be seen as drafting off another killer. It just doesn't jive with their particular brand of narcissism. And so, unable to admit an affinity for Zodiac's tactics, Berkowitz kept looking. In 1975, Zodiac was an incredibly infamous serial killer, but the biggest fish in the serial killer pond was Charles Manson. After acid-crazed members of his cult, the Manson family, perpetrated a senseless string of murders out west in Los Angeles in 1969, heralding in a dark decade, a decade Berkowitz was now hopelessly lost in. In the early 70s, there was a lot of coverage on Manson, and by this time, he was a household name, even more so than Zodiac.
About the Manson stuff.
Yeah.
Who read the book?
Helter Skelter, yeah. That was mainly court transcripts and things.
Berkowitz was researching murderers, and he was doing it just prior to becoming a murderer himself.
He didn't start looking up these kind of stories until after he came back to the
government. That's true. I don't know how it started, but I just did, you know.
Was it after you looked up your mother?
Just about that time when I was looking her up.
Berkowitz stated many times that it was only after meeting his birth mother, Betty Falco, that this aforetime mentioned change from internal rage monster to external violence junkie began to occur inside him. David Berkowitz had believed his entire life that he was responsible for his birth mother's death ever since he was told by his adoptive parents at the age of 5 that she had died while giving birth to him, And with this information, he had claimed her in his mind as his first victim. He suffered an intense amount of guilt over that, and now, after a great deal of legwork on his part, had found out that it was all a big lie. Due to that, his anger was now pointed outward, specifically at the attractive young women he had resented all along.
I was angry at my own incapabilities or something, and it eventually turned outward. When earlier in my life, it was all kept inward and repressed, I became outwardly aggressive after a period of time. Especially after all these movies and things, which seemed to encourage me. At that time, I agree, I had a pretty immature outlook towards everything.
Anger in hand and newly fashioned into a sword, he began to seek out representations in film and television of men who, rather than turning their anger and frustration against themselves, had turned it on others. He watched movies, he read books, he absorbed anything he could get his hands on.
He studied them and slowly worked up the psychological calluses that enabled him to finally divide the world into two circles. One very, very small and including only himself, and the other, every other human being on the planet, particularly young females, young, attractive, sexually attractive females, like his mother had at one time been.
David Berkowitz had been fixated on one mother or another his entire life, either his adoptive mother Pearl or his birth mother Betty, and along the way had been entirely unsuccessful with girls in his peer group, girls his own age. Now, at the ripe old age of 22, he had given up on both mothers and girlfriends alike, devoting himself completely to finding a killer to model himself after.
He identified with these guys and admired them for acting on this rage that had eaten away at them for so long. He began working on pushing himself. It's one thing to set arson fires and do malicious things behind people's back. It's another thing to walk out in public with a gun in your hand and start murdering people.
David Berkowitz was looking, but try as he may, DeSalvo, Zodiac, Manson, none of them seemed to fit. They were all a little too loud, a little too confrontational, too garish. David had always been a sneak, silent and deadly. He liked to operate in the shadows, not out in the open. So while he admired these scumbags, none of them worked as an example he could follow, at least not publicly. That is until he clicked on the TV in his apartment late one evening in October of 1975. There on the screen was a made-for-TV film called The Deadly Tower, starring a young Kurt Russell. The Deadly Tower carefully and dramatically depicted vicious murders carried out by Charles Whitman, who, after stabbing and killing his own wife and mother, climbed to the top of the University of Texas Tower in Austin, Texas, with a stockpile of weapons and fired round after round into an unsuspecting crowd, killing 16 and injuring 31 on August 1st, 1966. It should be noted that when referring to the film The Deadly Tower, Berkowitz mistakenly refers to the film as The Texas Tower after the actual location of the crimes. Regardless, something seemed to click for David.
The Texas Tower was based on a real crime. And he was doing, it seems, was taking his anger and frustration out against everybody else. As opposed to just going up to the tower and just jumping off without, you know, doing anybody else any harm, you see. He was angry probably at himself, but it went out with him, you know.
And you identified with him in that case.
There were, let's say, a few similarities between David Berkowitz and Charles Whitman. Whitman was ex-military, like Berkowitz. They had similar problems socially, they both murdered women, and they were about the same age at the time of their crimes. Whitman was 25 when he was shot and killed by Austin police, and Berkowitz was 25 when he was arrested.
Whitman was a loner, described as not being able to develop friendships. He was married, but he had killed his wife and his mother. So there's the misogynistic element. They both had military training, big factor. Both young men, the world had not dealt with them fairly, and somebody was going to pay.
It seemed Berkowitz had found his match in Whitman. Here was someone he could look up to, fashion himself after, and pretend to be. But there was one thing about Whitman and his crimes that didn't fit for Berkowitz, and it was a big one. While he liked the idea of turning his anger on a bunch of innocent people and taking their lives, he didn't want to die anymore. I mean, that was the thing he had just given up. This suicide death wish he had carried around his entire life concerning the death of his biological mother. The suicide death wish that had turned heroic after Pearl had died. He was done with all that. Dying himself wasn't going to work for him. It was clear to Berkowitz that when Whitman climbed the steps of the tower, he was aware it was a one-way trip. It was designed to be. And that wasn't what David wanted. David wanted to kill, and when he was done, he wanted to do it again. So he was going to have to make alterations.
I think he thought, I've thought of doing something like that. And this guy actually did it. He's dead now. Do I want to take the chance of being dead? So maybe I go about it in a different way. I don't have the courage to climb up with my rifles and wait to be shot by a SWAT team. So maybe there's a better way that I can release this incrementally.
Jack asked David, how long after seeing the deadly tower did he first attempt to murder a young woman?
How long after you saw that movie did you go out with a knife, attacked a woman, and she screamed, and you let her go, and you fled?
Yeah, she wasn't really hurt or anything, you know. I don't know what happened, you know. It's just, I didn't know what to do with all these frustrations and anger being built up, you know. Just started, at that point, it was when it was starting to turn out, what you see.
Why did you let her go after you had her?
Because I didn't really want to do anything, you see?
Did you?
I was confused, like I was driven between two points.
On Christmas Eve, 1975, a little more than 2 months after watching the deadly tower, David Berkowitz attacked a 15-year-old girl named Michelle Foreman with a hunting knife, stabbing her 6 times. It's important to note here, as far as the potential connections between the film and David's brutal attack of Michelle, is that while the bulk of the deadly tower covers the murders Whitman perpetrated from the top of the tower at the university in Austin, it also depicts, in its opening scenes, Whitman's vicious murder of his wife and mother with a knife. Act 2. Michelle Foreman. At 6:45 p.m. on the evening of December 24th, 1975, David Berkowitz was preparing to leave the apartment. Despite the bitter cold, he put on a thin denim jacket, tucked a hickory-handled hunting knife with a 3.5-inch blade into the waistband of his jeans, and headed out the door. As he was leaving, he thought to himself, quote, "The hunt is on," end quote.
It was a gradual buildup, and the next thing you know, I guess, made a decision to myself, almost unconsciously, to just begin prowling around looking for somebody to harm.
He drove south on Pelham Parkway, turned left on Eastchester, then Allerton. Allerton turned into Baychester, and after making a right onto Bartow, which crosses all 6 lanes of the New England Thruway overpass, reached his destination, Co-op City Boulevard. The main drag of Co-op City, where David had lived with his adoptive father, Nat, while attending high school. David Berkowitz was home again. Co-op City was the modern development of high-rise apartments where David and his adoptive father, Nat, had moved after Pearl's death in 1967, as well as the location where David had been so, quote-unquote, unsuccessful, as he saw it, with the young ladies he was interested in. It was also where the woman he viewed as his quote-unquote high school flame, Iris Gerhardt, had been unfaithful, according to him. Co-op City was all these things to David, so I don't think it was a coincidence he ended up there on this particular night. David was prowling, looking for someone to harm, and after making 3 passes down the boulevard, he saw what he was looking for. A beautiful young woman walking home alone. But she wasn't a woman. She was a girl. She was 15 years old. David Berkowitz pulled over and got out of the car. Quote, "I had a job to do and I was doing it," end quote. Here's our series producer, Allison Baker.
Michelle Foreman, a 15-year-old sophomore at Truman High in the Bronx, was walking home alone through the streets of Co-op City at 10:30 on Christmas Eve, 1975. She headed up a flight of concrete stairs to the pedestrian bridge over the Thomas E. Dewey Thruway at Baychester Avenue. As Michelle reached the center of the overpass, she suddenly felt a sensation in the back of her head, and then another, and then another. Above the chaotic din of the traffic below, headlights and shadows crisscrossed the sidewalk, Michelle frantically grabbed a nearby handrail and swung around to face her assailant. What she came face to face with was a man in a jean jacket, holding a bloody hunting knife just as he was about to attack her again. He quickly stabbed her in the head 3 more times. Michelle screamed in terror, desperately hoping someone would come to her rescue. But Michelle wasn't waiting. She fought back. She knew this was her chance to fight, to survive. She screamed and threw her arms out in front of herself, lunging towards her attacker. The man knocked her down to the ground, but she wasn't giving up. She swung her arms towards his legs, trying to get a hold of them. As the adrenaline coursed through her veins, she fought for her life. In turn, her assailant kicked his feet free of her grasp and broke out into a hobbled run down the bridge. Bloody and severely wounded, Michelle propped herself up and limped after the man in hopes of getting a better look at his face. After a few steps, she collapsed onto the street. Realizing she might bleed to death if she didn't get up, she gathered her strength and drug herself to the nearest building, which happened to be the building she was headed to before the attack. The building she lived in with her parents. She had been less than a block away. When she finally reached the building's front door, she pressed her finger against the buzzer before her legs buckled under her and she fell to the ground. She was lying next to the front door in a pool of her own blood when she was found by a neighbor and taken to a nearby hospital. Michelle had suffered 6 stab wounds from a hunting knife, one which had punctured her lung. Incredibly, Michelle survived the attack after a week-long stay in the hospital.
Quote, "That was a mess. It was a young girl. I had a small hunting knife with a blade 3.5 inches long. It was late at night, about 10:30 or 11. I saw her immediately. In my first attempt to kill, I didn't know how to do it. I stabbed her and she didn't do anything. She just looked at me. I stabbed her again. It was terrible. She screamed pitifully. It wasn't like the movies where the stabbed person falls down and is killed. I kept stabbing her with the knife. It made me sick. After a little while, I just couldn't tell whether she was stabbed or I was ripping her coat. I wasn't going to rape her or take her money. I was only going to kill her. That's all. She was screaming pitifully, and I didn't know what the hell to do. She was staring at my knife and screaming. She wasn't dying." David just looked at her thinking, quote, "Why aren't you dead?" end quote. David ran away and then, panting, tried to catch his breath against a chain-link fence along the New York State Thruway. From there, he could see 170 Dreiser Loop, the building he had lived in with Nat, in apartment 17B. Quote, "I attacked a girl. I put a knife on her several times. I realized I'd stabbed her. After the stabbing, I ran to my car." End quote. Asked how he felt after, he replied, quote, "Very strange, confused. I didn't understand what was happening to me. I had tried to kill," end quote. David Berkowitz got back in his car and started home. On his way, he stopped at a 24-hour diner only 100 yards away from the footbridge where he had viciously attacked a 15-year-old girl. While listening to police cars speeding towards the scene of the crime, he ordered a hamburger, French fries, and a glass of milk. It was just after midnight, Christmas Day. After a lifetime of pain and frustration, David Berkowitz violently attacked a young woman, approximately 6 months after first meeting his birth mother and just 2 months after seeing the film he says inspired him to the terrible deed. In one way, Berkowitz had done what he had set out to do. In another, it had not gone as planned, not by a long shot. It was far too close, too sloppy, and too confrontational. He could see her face and read her every emotion. And last but not least, to the best of his knowledge, the young woman had lived. That meant, in his mind, he had failed again. That was how he saw it. So he left the experience feeling even more enraged and conflicted than he had before. But now, he was officially a violent offender. Act 3. A Dog Named Harvey.
Call it bad luck or fate, but he moved to not just one, but three places sequentially where there were barking dogs.
No, I had just left the New Rochelle. See, I stormed out of that guy's house. I had only lived there. I only lived in his house for about 2 months because he told me there were no dogs there. I was going to move in with the plans on staying 3 or 4 years, but the noise was so unbearable with the dogs that I just packed up my stuff and slipped out at night and moved out. I didn't have to take any furniture because it wasn't mine. It was a studio apartment. So without furniture, without hardly any furniture at all, I moved to Yonkers to an unfurnished apartment, and I literally had to sleep on the floor for about 3 weeks until my bed came. And that was all. I had just a bed and all my clothes and stuff and boxes. This is why I felt like an outcast. I had nothing, zero.
As 1975 gave way to 1976 and the nation busied itself with the celebration of the bicentennial, David Berkowitz snuck out of his apartment in New Rochelle in the middle of the night and moved due west to the Pine View Apartments at 35 Pine Street in Yonkers, a suburb just north of the city, apartment 7E. From his new apartment on the 7th floor, David had a fantastic view of the Hudson River, as well as the Palisades, not that he appreciated it. In fact, his first item of business was to tack up thick gray carpets over the windows, blocking out the light, and along with it, the view. David Berkowitz was planning on getting some much-needed rest, or at least he was going to try.
Meanwhile, I was frustrated as hell. I felt really dejected. I had no steady, good job that I can depend on. No job satisfaction. No social life satisfaction. The environment was terrible. There was nothing in the apartment. Nothing at all. Just my clothes, my guns, and my bed. And it was just all these circumstances, combined into one. And this is what happened.
In order to escape the Doberman pinchers on Barnes Avenue in the Bronx, David Berkowitz had sold all his furniture and taken a furnished apartment in New Rochelle. Now, fleeing again, this time from German Shepherds, David moved to an unfurnished apartment in Yonkers, where, sans furniture, he lay in a highly agitated state on a bare mattress on the floor, desperately trying to sleep. As he did, he heard the loud, shrill shrieking of a dog barking below his window. That dog's name was Harvey.
So eventually, after 3 moves, supposedly to get away from barking dogs, he moves next to this guy, Sam Carr, and his family, who own a black lab named Harvey, who, like all dogs, from time to time barks, and sometimes when David is trying to sleep.
David Berkowitz wasn't getting any rest, and he wasn't finding any peace. And in his mind, it was all because of his inconsiderate neighbor, Sam Carr, and his dog, Harvey.
Because his dog didn't bark just once in a while. It was unbelievable. I don't think any human being could have taken it. And I can't see how other people in the building never seemed to pay any mind to it. It's got to be one of the most annoying sounds, especially the way this dog barked, Squeaky and loud. And I don't know. Oh, it was taxing on my nerves.
Now, David lived in a 7-story apartment building, but Sam Carr lived in a big old wooden house 200 feet below David's window at 316 Warburton Avenue, where he ran a telephone answering service in his retirement. Carr was a 63-year-old chain smoker with a wife and three children, two boys and a girl. His daughter was 26 years old and married with the last name of Wheat and worked as a dispatcher for the Yonkers Police Department. His oldest son, John, was serving with the United States Air Force in North Dakota, while his younger son, Michael, cut hair out of their home. And of course, there was Harvey.
Sam Carr was an old retired guy at that time, factory worker kind of guy with a daughter and two sons, and sort of like an Archie Bunker with a couple of dogs out back that barked all the time, and a daughter who worked as a dispatcher for the local police department. Nondescript kind of old guy who lived in a neighborhood where there were rental apartments, and unfortunately, one of the tenants who moved in was a guy who was coming in with a lifetime of rage and hatred that he had already begun to attach to barking animals that disturbed his sleep.
Let's just say David was upset by the situation, so he sought his own remedies to resolve the problem, none of which involved having a face-to-face conversation with Sam Carr. And of all the things he did try, he just wants you to know that none of them were crazy. David Berkowitz is a sensible guy.
I tried writing nasty letters and things. This isn't insanity at all. This is really just an immature way to deal with somebody's frustrations. Like a normal person may have gone to his door and shook their fist right in front of his nose and says, "Now shut that hell up with that, you know, put that dog inside." But I couldn't approach him for some reason directly. So I had to do all these roundabout things, you know. That was one of the major motivations for these crimes, too. You know, a series of factors, because it made life so unbearable. And I couldn't get away from the dog. You know, why couldn't you move? No, you don't understand. This was my third move in 2 years. I was out of money.
David was out of gas, mentally, emotionally, and certainly financially. He didn't have the time, patience, or understanding to deal with his life. He was stuck. It was around this time, in May of 1976, that an incident occurred at work. David was assigned to guard a warehouse at West 31st Street and 10th Avenue in Manhattan, and ironically, had been assigned three large dogs to work with. Apparently, David was one of the only guards who was even willing to work with the dogs. A coworker saying, quote, "David was the only one who could walk the guard dogs. A lot of the others were afraid," end quote. Surprisingly, David himself said of the experience, quote, "I loved those dogs. We were buddies. I took care of them, fed them, bathed them," end quote. That didn't stop one of the dogs from biting him. David's psychiatrist later asked him what happened after the dog bit him. Question, "What did you do?" Answer, "I bit him back." Question, "You what?" Answer, "Oh no, I was only joking. I gave him the chains. The dogs were off the leash. I was usually by myself. I liked the dogs. I didn't want to leave them." It was shortly after the incident that David decided to take a road trip. David Berkowitz decided it was time to drive to Texas and visit an old army buddy in Houston by the name of Billy Dan Parker. Act 4. You talking to me?
At some point, David Berkowitz decided he wanted to take a road trip and reconnects with an old army buddy who lived in Texas. He went through Florida on the way, spent a little bit of time with his adoptive father and Nat's wife.
David headed south to Texas, but first he thought he'd make a pit stop in Florida to see his adoptive father Nat and his new wife in Boynton Beach. Preferring the solitude of driving at night, David slept during the day, and since he didn't have much money, when he did stop, he slept in the car. When he woke, he continued south on I-95 until he reached Smithville, South Carolina, where he decided he wanted to watch some tube and sleep in a bed, so he coughed up $8.50 for a trucker's motel. That night, while grabbing dinner at a nearby diner, he saw a trucker getting handsy with a platinum blonde at the table across from him, the blonde giggling with every touch. Disturbed and repulsed by the interaction, David sat as far away from the pair as he could, and as soon as he finished eating, he left. Having witnessed enough human interaction to last him for a while, He went back to sleeping in the car, spending his final quote-unquote night on the shoulder of Highway 204 in Georgia. The next day, he arrived at Nat's new home at the Village Royal on the Green Retirement Complex, Unit 2601. He was there for a week. The trip was awkward.
He felt uneasy around his adoptive father's new wife, with whom he had at best cordial relationship. And I think that also there was baggage between them going back to his childhood as a malicious kid who had maybe contributed to the death of Nat's first wife through his constant attempts to antagonize and irritate and sabotage her.
In the daytime, David attempted, in his own way, to reconnect with Nat. But at night, he attempted to connect with people his own age at the single bars of Fort Lauderdale. A patron later had this to say of him. Quote, "He was a quiet listener who would timidly attempt to join animated conversation. He'd interject a few comments with his bemused smile, then quickly be cut out of the group as an odd duck. Then he'd retreat and try to strike up conversation with others," end quote. Back at Nat's house, things were about the same. Regardless, Nat and his new wife invited David to stay and start a new life with them in Florida. David declined. Quote, "There was nothing down there for me to work at. I mean, I needed a job and Florida was high unemployment. Got to be realistic. I had no money. Live with Dad? I couldn't do that because there was no way I could get along with his new wife, Julia. Julia and I could never live in the same house," end quote.
He wanted to be alone. He had no desire to develop a long-term lasting relationship with anybody.
When David declined Nat's offer, it was the second time David Berkowitz declined an opportunity to leave the city that was driving him crazy. His refusal to stay in Fort Knox, Kentucky, after his discharge from the military, being the first. And so, David got back in the car and headed west to Houston, where he would stay with his old Army buddy, Billy Dan Parker, a tall, 23-year-old construction worker with short, cropped hair who lived in a ranch-style house in the suburbs with his mom. David arrived on June 5th, 1976. It was there in Texas, during that incredibly short window, that two monumental things happened. The first was that David Berkowitz would see the movie that would have by far the greatest influence on his murderous deeds to come. David Berkowitz saw Taxi Driver. And it was Dan's idea.
That night, he said, "You want to see a good movie?" I say, "A really good movie I like. This is my friend Dan, right?" And I says, "Well, yeah, all right, I haven't been to the movie in a while." And he took me to see Taxi Driver.
They were looking for something to do one evening, and his buddy said, "There's a great De Niro movie, Taxi Driver, you know, you want to check it out?"
For those not familiar, Taxi Driver is a 1976 film starring Robert De Niro and directed by Martin Scorsese. The film's main character, Travis Bickle, played by De Niro, is a young Vietnam veteran with zero social skills who moves to New York City after the war and works as a cab driver in an attempt to re-enter polite society. Along the way, he meets and becomes enamored with a young Sybil Shepherd, and after asking her out on a date, monumentally blows it by taking her to a pornographic film in Times Square. After that, it's a pretty swift descent into darkness for Bickle, and soon he starts amassing a stockpile of weapons. Although wholly unaccepted by society, Travis views himself as above it somehow, and is generally repulsed by the condition of the city, as well as what he interprets to be the general decline of civilization that he witnesses driving the graveyard shift. Observations which lead him to utter one of the film's most famous lines.
"Someday a real rain will come and wash all this scum off the streets."
To that end, possibly imagining himself as the rain that's going to transform the city, Bickle decides he is going to use his recently amassed stockpile to free a very young Jodie Foster from the bonds of prostitution by murdering her pimp, Harvey Keitel, which he does along with a few other people. In a twist of fate, he ends up being regarded as a hero after narrowly surviving the wounds he sustained during the final shootout of the film's climax. Honestly, and aside from its connection to Berkowitz, it's a hell of a film and has gone down in the history books as one of the great cult films of the 20th century.
Before becoming aware of David Berkowitz, I became aware of the movie Taxi Driver. I'm a veteran, served during the Vietnam War, and all of us came home with feelings of having been shoved aside in some hostility and having been trained to, you know, take matters into our own hands if we got pushed too hard, too far. A lot of us identified in some way with Robert De Niro in that movie, doing the wrong things for what you sincerely believe are good reasons.
David Berkowitz identified with De Niro's portrayal of the Travis Bickle character in a major way.
David immediately identified the character portrayed by Robert De Niro so effectively and chillingly in that movie. An ex-military person who was living alone in a cramped apartment, stockpiling weapons, which he had already begun to do.
It was a spot-on match to David's life. Travis was a veteran, an outcast, and totally unsuccessful with women. The only female friend he ever had, a sex worker, same as Berkowitz. Same as Berkowitz, he was a bit of a prude, all while carrying around a fairly advanced superiority complex. They both lived in New York City in the same time period, and also, they were the same age. The list goes on and on.
The character that Robert De Niro played so well in Taxi Driver could have been almost written based on David Berkowitz's life. Someone who was born to be a loner, who had very few social graces, and even when they tried to do the right thing to develop a friendship, always said the wrong thing or did the wrong thing, and was clumsy in a way, and socially clumsy. That was Berkowitz to a T. In addition to the fact that he had already started stockpiling weapons and nursing this anger, he was already over the edge, and that just solidified in his mind that he should start shooting other human beings.
Travis, just like David, was a sexually confused, frustrated loner type who had convinced himself that his anger and his tendencies toward violence were justified. Taxi Driver, in some magical way, checked all the boxes, gave him the permission he was cosmically looking for. In Berkowitz's mind, it had all come down to this, and now he was standing alone in front of a bank of green lights. Part of the appeal was that here was a character that he could emulate, that was fictitious, a character he could inject with what he had picked up from Zodiac without being labeled a copycat. He could be the real-life Travis Bickle and not an uninspired repeat of someone else. It worked for his particular brand of narcissism. But it wasn't just about finding the perfect murderer to emulate, it was about finding the perfect gun as well. Remember, David lived in New York City, where it was illegal to purchase a handgun, and due to that fact, David only owned rifles, which are hard to conceal. Shotguns are okay if you plan to die in the end, like Whitman had, but Berkowitz wasn't interested in suicide anymore. He wanted to kill, and he wanted to live so he could do it again. If he could become a hero in the process, such as Travis Bickle had, then even better. And so, when David Berkowitz saw Taxi Driver, he was convinced he had found not only the role model, but also the gun he was looking for.
When did you get the .44?
That was when I went to Texas. That was in in June of 76. I went to Texas, right? And it was there, right?
It just so happened that a shiny, silver-plated .44 caliber revolver was included in the stockpile of weapons Travis Bickle purchased in a hotel room from a gun dealer in the film. And the .44 isn't just a gun featured in the movie. It's clearly defined in the film as the concentrated expression point of violence towards women. In the film, a coked-up passenger, played by Martin Scorsese, gets in the back seat of Travis's cab and directs him to an apartment. Once there, the passenger explains that his wife is having sex with another man, and then, pulling out the .44 and showing it to Bickle, explains that he is going to shoot her with it.
I'm going to kill her. I'm going to kill her with a .44 Magnum pistol. See, did you ever see what a .44 Magnum pistol would do to a woman's face? Now, did you ever see what it can do to a woman's pussy?
Berkowitz was hooked.
The next day, I bought the .44.
He was in the perfect place to pick one up.
And then, after I saw the movie the next day, I said, you know, Dan, I didn't tell him why, you know. New York's awful dangerous city, and so much crime. I've been mugged before. When I have been mugged, you know. I said, oh, I can sure use a gun. He said, you want me to get your gun? All right.
The next day, he and his buddy going out and going shopping.
On June 12, 1976, David Berkowitz and Billy Dan Parker walked into the Spring Branch Jewelry and Loan Shop at 8715 Long Point Avenue in Houston. Bill Wheeler, the man behind the counter, sold Parker the Charter Arms Bulldog 44 revolver for $130 in cash, along with three boxes of ammunition. Outside in the parking lot, Dan gave the pistol to David. The Charter Arms Bulldog 44 weighed 18 ounces and was easy to conceal. It had been recently redesigned just 2 years before as a specific departure from the early 20th century model, which was big, heavy, and hard to hide. The previous design was featured not just in films like Taxi Driver, where Travis, psyching himself up for his crimes, pulls the gun from a holster, points it at a mirror, and says another of the film's most famous lines.
You talking to me?
The gun was also featured in 1971's Dirty Harry, where Clint Eastwood points the gun at a quote-unquote bad guy and recites that film's titular line.
Go ahead, make my day.
That was the .44 Magnum revolver, an absolutely massive gun with a nearly debilitating recoil, a virtual hand cannon. A gun that isn't meant to be hidden, but rather waved around like a flag. The Charter Arms Bulldog 44, however, was specifically designed to be small, lightweight, and easy to conceal, all while maintaining maximum bullet size and weight. The Bulldog 44 had all the chic of the gun in the film and none of the setbacks. It was everything he was looking for. Now it was his. And Dan, being a Texan, born and bred, buying a gun for a friend seemed perfectly on the level. New York was dangerous and David needed to protect himself. Dan would say later, quote, it was my best friend asking. I saw no reason not to help him out, end quote. And besides, everyone Dan knew carried guns.
His whole family carried guns. His mother had shot a guy once when they lived in Louisiana, shot a burglar. No, the police, she was justified. You know, a guy tried to come in through the front door, and she shot him in the chest. She carries a .38 snub nose in her purse wherever she goes. I'm looking at all these people. A father packs a gun to go off to work. No, they're perfectly law-abiding citizens. They're stable. There's nothing wrong with them. They're normal. Me being a New Yorker, and guns such a, they're impossible to find, especially pistols, unless you're a cop or something, you know, or unless you've got a political pull. If you tried to go in and buy a gun in New York State, in a store in New York, without all the paperwork, you couldn't do it.
As a Jewish New Yorker, it's safe to say David Berkowitz was blown away by Texas gun culture.
Now, in Texas, you can buy guns anywhere. You can buy guns in the supermarket. All you have to do is be a resident of Texas and have your driver's license with a picture on the back that resembles you. You can buy. You can go in and buy three or four pistols in one shot. No questions asked. You just fill out that silly form, or whoever you remember. You know that 10-question form? Well, are you mental deviant, yes or no? They ask you that. Are you religious? Are you a mental case? Yes or no? Are you a communist, or you know, you participating in any anti-gun thing, government thing? Yes or no? Do you have a criminal record? Yes or no? And, it'll be the most ridiculous form you've ever seen in your life.
Not only could you buy them, but it was easy.
He talked about being amazed at how ubiquitous guns were, and how that his friend's mother carried one in her purse, and that everybody had a gun. And anybody who lived in a place like New York City, where there's so much crime, really needed to have a gun, something they could conceal for self-defense. So his buddy filled out this one single-page form, and he picked out a .44.
Put it on his name. You know, I just went along as somebody who was doing shopping with him, and the store owner didn't even look at you, you know? And he had all the guns laid out, and we shopped around. How about this gun, Dave? You think it's nice? I says, yeah, Dan, that's a good one. That was the .44 Bulldog, you know, because it was inexpensive, $125 then. And it had, you know, it was small and powerful, you know, it was .44. So he said, all right, I'll take this one. And they gave him he filled out that silly form. And that was it. We walked out with the gun. And this is Texas, in New York State. Forget about it.
In New York City, it was illegal to own a handgun. And even if you fell under one of the exceptions, it was a mountain of paperwork. You had to first possess a pistol permit, and then after that, you had to get a purchase order from the New York City Police Department. Both were difficult and time-consuming procedures, and they were that way on purpose. Of course, you could get a gun off the street, but David Berkowitz wasn't interested in that.
In New York, there is an attempt to restrain gun murders and the ability to inflict violence and injury on other human beings. You have to fill out all kinds of paperwork just to buy ammo. New York City makes it as difficult as possible to purchase and use firearms. In Texas, there's a culture of, I have the right to defend myself whether or not you are armed. If you offend me in word or deed in any manner whatsoever. If you're not carrying a gun, you're thought of as being some kind of sissy.
It was a true culture clash.
I couldn't conceive of how easy it is to get guns in Texas. He couldn't conceive of why it should be so difficult to get guns in New York. He says, man, we need guns. We get people mugged and shot all over the place. And Texas does have one of the highest murder rates, you know.
Probably because they have so many guns.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. And he says, well, my mom carries a gun in the glove compartment, and she carries a gun in her purse, and we take the guns to go to church. And that's the way it is down there. And so I bought a gun.
After his arrest, David was asked why he purchased the .44. Question: what was the purpose of buying the gun? Answer: I knew I was going to do something with it. Question: what would that be? Answer: I think it was going to be shooting people, you know? Question: shooting people? Answer: yeah.
You went out to visit your friend there in Texas, and it was how long after that that the crime started?
Oh, about a month and a half, 2 months.
It was 1 month. Jack asks David if he ever considered staying in Texas rather than heading back to the city that was driving him absolutely bananas.
Did the thought ever occur to you that, hey, you know, maybe I'll move out here to Texas where people are freer and looser? And
I thought about it, yeah. He persuaded me to move out there. Sorry. He said there were a great number of jobs available, and I had bought a lot of newspapers when I was down there to look at the classified sections. Still, it was all skilled labor they required, so I didn't move. And I knew nobody over there except him, and it was hot as hell. I had no money to make the move, so.
David declined Dan's offer to stay.
He could not be too close to people for more than days at a time, whether it was his own adoptive father, whether it was his biological mother, half-sister, friends. He was incapable of any sort of sustained friendship or family loyalty. He was a solitary person, and he only felt comfortable when he was alone.
Here in Texas, for the third and final time, we see David Berkowitz refuse an offer to leave New York City and its numerous annoyances in order to bask in the relative peace and silence of the countryside, opting instead to head back to the city, this time forever. Quote, "They were very hospitable and they liked me, you know. But you don't overextend yourself for guests. I can't do that myself, overextend. I had no money, no money. No matter how much I wanted to move, I didn't have any money. I was just making enough to pay bills. I had no clothes or nothing." End quote. Excuses, excuses. The real reason David Berkowitz didn't move to Texas was the same reason he didn't stay in Florida, the same reason he didn't stay in Kentucky. David Berkowitz had a plan. Even back in Kentucky, I think, he had some idea, albeit a hazy one, that he would go back to New York and at least bask in his hate, if not launch an all-out war on those he felt had wronged him.
A couple of days later, he left Texas and drove back to New York with the weapon that's going to murder and maim 13 people in the next 13 months or so.
He already had what he'd come there for, the easy-to-conceal Charter Arms Bulldog 44 five-shot revolver.
Although he hadn't specifically said that he went to Texas to buy a gun, it seemed like when his friend bought the gun for him and gave it to him, he realized, that's really all I came for. Consciously or subconsciously, very soon began making plans to drive back to New York and decided against his friend's advice to stay there and start a new life in Texas.
Next thing you know, I was heading back to New York with 44. And it, of course, was just a matter of time as I was getting more angry and frustrated with life, with the barking of the dogs and my social life and everything else, sexual tensions and frustrations building. At the same time, I had accumulated this large arsenal of guns. And actually, it was only a matter of time, since I was a person who, since childhood, has always had a tendency to vent his aggression through antisocial means, you know what I mean? It was just a matter of time before the guns and my anger were going to blend together and we were going to go to, you see. And I say again, this isn't insanity at all. It's just a tremendous series of all these circumstances building up to 1% of our violence, you know.
With the 44 in his glove box and the Travis Bickle character in his mind, David Berkowitz was heading back to New York City, the center of his rage, and left Houston on June 12, 1976, just hours after acquiring the 44. According to Section 265.05 of the New York State Penal Law, David would be required to register the 44 once it was within city limits. But this, he failed to do. The Bulldog 44 was the missing piece in the arsenal he'd been amassing since getting out of the military. Now, his arsenal was finished and ready to put to use. Next time on Killer Tape, David commits his first murder.
Came home from work tired and without much money, and it built up because the first crime wasn't the first time I was out in the street, you see. I was out. I guess I knew what my intentions were. I don't know why, you know. I look back and see how silly it was. I mean, you know, and I don't want to use that word. I look back and see how nonsensical the whole thing was, how senseless, pointless. But I was so angry, I just didn't care anymore. I just walked up to this one car in the first shooting, you know, and I just started shooting the gun.
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistance by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Wildenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Killer Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D., and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt and Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.